Coming up on Weekend America.
There were calls for calm when King died.
This is no way. We are black. We are black. Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Can't y'all go back down and let's do the show together? We're black. Don't make us all look bad.
The night the Godfather of Soul became a prince for peace. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. King's death even touched Broadway.
So he's coming up, and I said, Ed, what's happening? He says, he's dead. And I, really not wanting to know the answer, said, who's dead?
An unforgettable opening night. And later, how did you fill out your NCAA brackets?
Connecticut versus San Diego.
I think San Diego still has a higher median house price right now. So I'm going to, I'll say San Diego then.
Ah, don't bet on it. On Week in America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. In St. Paul, I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. The Final Four is narrow this weekend. That's the NCAA basketball tournaments. Charlie Schroeder is a tournament know-nothing, so he'll have to use his creativity to get in on the excitement. We'll get with Charlie later this hour. What are you doing this weekend?
This weekend I have to work on getting the snow off my roof.
This weekend I'm doing my application for law review. I plan on going up to Baltimore and going to the Baltimore Orioles game tomorrow night.
This weekend I'm going to be doing some painting in my house.
I plan on going swing dancing at a place called Nick's in Virginia.
I am waiting the arrival of my little sister. She's coming for my 30th birthday.
Well, my weekend plans, I never know. If somebody calls and wants to do something Saturday or Sunday, I do it. I'm never bored.
May she never know the Saturday night wait by the silent phone.
Yes, those voices came from Lincoln, Nebraska, Washington, D.C., and Concord, New Hampshire.
On April 5th, 1968, 40 years ago exactly, the country was reeling from the murder of Martin Luther King the night before. Riots had broken out in several cities, and many more cities were on the brink of chaos. James Brown was scheduled to play at the sold-out 14,000-seat Boston Gardens. It was a potential flashpoint right in the heart of downtown. Week in America's Michael May takes a look back at that tense day in Boston.
Music journalist Tom Vickers was one of the few white people with a ticket to the James Brown concert that night. He was 18 years old at the time. He grew up in Boston and was a huge fan of R&B. He was well aware of just how much tension there was between whites and blacks in the city. For the most part, whites stayed in South Boston, and blacks stayed in a neighborhood called Roxbury.
If you were a black person and you were found on the streets of South Boston, day or night, you know, you were lucky to escape alive. And quite frankly, the inverse was true. If you were a white person walking the streets of Roxbury, there was danger. You know, you could feel it. It was palpable.
The tension had been escalating in the mid-60s as the city began to desegregate its public schools. The mayoral race in 1967 pitted a liberal reformer, Kevin White, against Louise Day Hicks, an opponent of desegregation. Hicks ran under the evasive slogan, "You know where I stand." White won the race by less than 12,000 votes. So Boston's race relations were already on a short fuse when Martin Luther King was shot and killed on April 4, 1968. John Jabbo Starks, the drummer in James Brown's band, was heading into town to play the Boston Gardens when he heard the news.
That was such a tragedy. It was sad, and then it was shameful. It was like almost like as if you were drained. We're trying to bet ourselves, and then this happens.
Riots broke out across the country, and some feared Boston would be next. Tom Vickers remembered there was some rioting in Roxbury Friday night that was quickly stopped.
Yet there was this ongoing fear that there would be mass rioting in Boston, that, you know, the African-American community would spread into these various communities in Boston and just tear up the place.
In fact, city leaders were terrified that the James Brown concert would bring the violence right into the heart of downtown. Mayor Kevin White and Boston's first black city council member, Thomas Atkins, debated whether or not to cancel the concert. They talked about the decision in a VH1 documentary. Mayor Kevin White speaks first.
His concert, we thought, might bring as many as 15 or 20,000 black people from the community, particularly young people, into the city. It just had too much emotion in it not to decide whether that would be a problem.
And I said, Kevin, you are doing exactly the wrong thing. If the word gets out in the black community that the city would not let James Brown come to town and perform in the wake of King's assassination, I said, all hell will break loose.
The city had only a few hours to find a compromise. Meanwhile, Tom Vickers went to a somber memorial for Dr. King that afternoon in Government Center near downtown. Afterwards, he went to the Boston Gardens and asked a large Irish policeman if the show was still going to happen.
And he said, yeah, it's going to happen, but if I were you, I'd just turn in your tickets and get a refund. And I said, well, if the show's going to happen, why would I want to do that? And he said, well, it could be a little edgy here tonight, and here's the good news. They're going to show the concert tonight on WGBH. They're going to broadcast the entire show.
The mayor held a press conference to encourage people to stay home and watch it in the safety of their living room. Vickers cashed in his tickets at the box office, as did thousands of others.
Give another round of applause for James Brown.
That night, around 9 p.m., James Brown walked on stage at the Boston Gardens, and Mayor White was by his side. White addressed the crowd of around 2,000 and the row of television cameras.
Now, I'm here tonight, like all of you, to listen to James. But I'm also here to ask for your help. I'm here to ask you to stay with me as your mayor and to make Dr. King's dreams a reality in Boston. This is our city, and its future is in our hands. Tonight, tomorrow, and the days that follow. So all I ask you tonight is this. Well, let us look at each other, here in the gardens and back at home, and pledge that no matter what any other community might do, we in Boston will honor Dr. King in peace. Thank you.
And with that, James Brown, dressed in all black, grabs the microphone and takes over.
I want you to know,
ain't no sin, because I'm writing with my friends. My friends. My friends. To do it all over again. But that's life.
Jabbo Starks was on the drums. He said as soon as he dug into the groove, the intense sadness he was feeling just lifted.
I love to play. Any problems, anything that I've had is vented because I don't hear, see, or think of anything else except I'm playing that music. It's a relief for me.
Tom Vickers and his family crowded around the TV set in their living room and watched in amazement.
James Brown always gave everything, but at this show, there was an emotional edge to it, and he just seemed totally present, in the moment, on fire, and giving 110%.
Help me now.
Then, just as James Brown dons his golden cape, a young man jumps on stage, and in an instant, a white police officer rushes in and throws the man back into the audience. It looks like the beginning of a riot that the entire city of Boston will witness on TV.
When they came on stage, they was just, I think they were just venting that anger or something out, and they just wanted to, get up and be close to him or get close to whatever. However the mind was going, I can't say, but I know that when the police started trying to throw him off stage, that's when it became a little touchy there.
Brown tells the police officers to let him handle it, and he shakes hands with another teenager who's jumped on stage. Suddenly, fans swarm the singer.
It was almost to a point that it was getting ready to be something really bad to happen.
We're black. Don't make us all look bad. Let me finish doing the show.
But when he stopped it, he saw that, he stopped it, and he could do that. He had that kind of power. People would listen to him.
Within a couple of minutes, the Godfather of Soul clears the stage.
Now, I asked the police to step back because I figured I could get some respect for my own people. That makes sense. And are we together, we? Yeah. Get the thing, man.
That night, there was rioting in over 100 U.S. cities. Dozens of people were killed. Huge areas of Newark, Detroit, and Washington, D.C. went up in flames. But Boston remained quiet. People stayed inside their homes, captivated by the James Brown Show. I'm Michael May for Weekend America.
The documentary The Night James Brown Saved Boston premieres tonight on VH1. There's extended video from that show at our website. Go back to a night many will never forget. It's all at weekinamerica.org. King's assassination was unforgettable for those who lived through it, not only for what it meant to history, but how it affected them directly.
Stay with us this hour. We're going to bring you another story about how news of King's assassination made one family mourn for what had happened and wonder forever what might have been.
Funky. Down. Nasty.
Hey, listen to the man.
Well, Godfather.
Payback.
Cold-blooded.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
A missile shield on Russia's porch, a lawsuit to stop the end of the world, and will someone please answer the White House telephone? Good news, bad news, no news, next on Weekend America. This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This weekend, the Sunday TV chat shows will be judging the Clinton family tax returns. Like most of us, the Clintons made $100 million in the last 8 years. We've got some other news on our mind. Let's bring in our good news, bad news, no news panel. This week, it's New Yorker magazine cartoon editor Bob Mankoff. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Writer, comedian Dana Gould. Hi, Dana.
Hi.
And author, political commentator Nancy French. Welcome back, Nancy.
Hello.
Our first topic, this week in Romania, NATO gave its endorsement to a U.S. missile defense system based in Europe. Russia's President Putin says this is bad news. It will fuel a new arms race. He threatened to aim missiles at the system. What do you say? Is NATO's missile shield blessing good news, bad news, or no news?
I say it's good news because I'm for all these shields. I want a missile shield and like a shield for the nuke in the suitcase and a shield for like the bioweapon in the sock.
Mm-hmm.
So just the more shields, the better.
Bring back shields and Yarnell.
My feet have been called a bioweapon in a sock.
Well, I think that aspect of it was good news because no matter what President Bush said that he saw in Putin's eyes, I think that we should not kowtow to them and, you know, obey all of their whims. I think that it was great that they agreed to do this missile defense, but in other aspects of the conference, I think it didn't go as well.
My concern with the bad side of this is, to my knowledge, the missile shield doesn't work. Unless I'm sorely mistaken, it just fails test after test.
Yeah. But a false sense of security is actually what gets you up in the morning.
I
like the idea that most people will believe in the missile defense system. I don't think just because it doesn't work. I mean, I think that's sort of nitpicking, Dana.
It's a $100 billion sugar pill.
You know, when they called it Operation Duck and Cover, I knew we were in trouble.
Our next topic. So far, the most famous TV ad of this presidential campaign, of course, is Senator Clinton's It's 3 a.m. The White House phone is ringing spot. It was considered a jab at Senator Obama's lack of experience. This week, Clinton came out with another ad. And what time is it now?
It's 3 a.m., and your children are safe and asleep. But there's a phone ringing in the White House, and this time the crisis is economic. Home foreclosures mounting, markets teetering. John McCain just said the government shouldn't take any real action on the housing crisis. He'd let the phone keep ringing. Hillary Clinton has a plan to protect our
obviously,
homes.
She thinks the 3 a.m. series is effective. Is it good news, bad news, or no news?
Look, if Hillary Clinton is president and the telephone rings at 3 a.m., Bill Clinton's going to look over and say, don't pick it up and she'll just stop calling.
How can you have an economic crisis at 3 a.m.? I mean, the stores are closed. What can
excellent
you do
point
at 3 a.m., even if you want to?
Oh, there are nasty bankers in three-piece suits confronting people in their pajamas at 3 a.m., breaking their kids' piggy banks.
But what kind of news is this?
I say it's bad news because apparently the only criteria for being president is being a light sleeper or having staffers who don't understand the value of email.
I think it's good news only because I so enjoy presidential campaigns, and her unrelenting brazenness is constantly entertaining. Here's Hillary Clinton in a losing death match with Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And she's spending what little money she has to go after John McCain by doing a ridiculous version of a much criticized ad. It's like a diamond of futility. Every facet of it is wrong.
Brazenly. What was she? Is she brazenly entertaining? It sounds like something good for a personal.
She's, yeah, exactly.
I'm brazenly entertaining.
She's like the knight in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah,
she's down to like her torso.
Yeah.
Get over here.
Our next topic. We all know how vital it is that we drink at least 8 glasses of water a day for optimal health. This has been pounded into us for decades. And this week, University of Pennsylvania researchers told us, that's not true. You can just drink when you're thirsty. That's fine. Is this revelation good news, bad news, or no news?
It's great news for the environment because no one was drinking these glasses of water. They were walking around with these bottles.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, at Condé Nast, it's like they're on some sort of Survivor tour.
Nancy?
I think it's bad news if you're a member of the bottled water industry, but
yes,
good news otherwise.
Yeah, some people have suggested that Evian spelled backwards is naive. I can't confirm that, but
need a sophisticated computer program.
There's no way to find out.
No, we'll never know. I'm just saying it's been suggested.
I'm still trying to work it out. It's horrible.
Our last topic. Two men have filed a lawsuit in federal court to stop the building of a giant particle accelerator in Switzerland. The men say the unprecedented epic smashing of protons could produce a black hole that would swallow the Earth, maybe even the universe. Particle physicists say this is very unlikely. Not the complete dismissal I wanted to hear. Is this lawsuit good, bad, or no news?
Good news.
Good news.
Because it finally brings litigation into Armageddon. And now they should redo Planet of the Apes. So Charlton Heston sees the Statue of Liberty and just falls off his horse and says, I'll sue!
I'll see you in court, you damn dirty litigants.
They blew it up. I'll see you in court.
It's got a ring.
I think it's bad news because one of the scientists that was trying to defend it, you know, he said, well, there's some probability that it could happen, that it could be the end of the world or these mini black holes could occur and, you know, eat the entire planet. But he said that it's also possible that the collider might make dragons, quote, that could eat us up.
Huh?
Which is, I know he said that there's a small possibility that anything could happen in quantum physics.
That's true.
He says if that happened, he just said to drink 8 glasses of water and the dragon won't find you intelligible.
Okay.
But now I'm not so sure.
I feel better then because I believe it.
I mean, I don't believe any of it. I mean, any of it. I mean, this is why people actually turn to religion, because science becomes incomprehensible. No, actually, this is why it's string theory. You know, when it was like an atom and the nucleus and it's like looks like the solar system and, you know, it's Newton, you can understand that now it's like 26 dimensions and the string's a billion miles long and they're round up and, I don't know, something with mayonnaise and it all works.
One of the differences between science and religion is science, by and large, admits when it's wrong.
Out.
If not a black hole, the proton collisions could also, they say, produce something called a strangelet that would convert our planet to a dense, dead lump of something called strange matter, which is what happened to Carrot Top and Phil Spector.
Yeah. But there'll be a great T-shirt or something.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
The Earth was eaten by a black hole, turned into a strangelet, and all I got is this lousy T-shirt.
Well, the explanation of how this works is normally preceded by the phrase, since you won't live to tell anyone, Mr. Bond, let me explain my operation.
That's the news this week. Panel, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bob Mankoff is cartoon editor at The New Yorker magazine. Nancy French is author of A Red State of Mind, How a Catfish Queen Reject Became a Liberty Bell. Comedian Dana Gould's credits include The Simpsons. And Dana will be performing tonight in Los Angeles at the Steve Allen Theater. It's a benefit for the Myla Nurmi Memorial Fund. Myla Nurmi was a friend of Dana's, and she was the actress who created the Vampira character in the 1950s. She passed away in Los Angeles in January of this year. This is Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
If you live in a place where spring hasn't yet sprung, never fear. We have experts who will tell you when it's arrived. Mrs. Drillman's Kindergarten Class, coming up on Weekend America. Thanks for sharing your weekend with us. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. It's that time of year again. For 2 days this week, it's been 90 plus in Laredo, Texas, and colder than negative 14 in Lake Yellowstone, Wyoming. Well, that's spring for you. Coat debating season. Do you wear one? Do you leave it at home? That question has taken on a new meaning for one resident of Oakland, California, a 15-foot, 1,500-pound resident. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark has the story.
The giraffe exhibit at the Oakland Zoo strives for a certain authenticity. The yard includes gazelle, a griffin vulture, and several loud Egyptian geese, the same animals giraffes hang out with in the African veldt. But the zookeeper, Amy Phelps, knows not everything is like it would be in nature. First off, at the zoo, the giraffes get snacks for good behavior.
Cinnamon raisin bagels, bananas, carrots, bread.
Unlike the wild, giraffes here are safe from predators. They sleep in stalls. And when it's cold out, there's this coat.
It's very large, difficult to move around. It's green, hunter green. It has just the right amount of quilting for the winter and some little Velcro straps on it to keep it secured to her.
It looks like a giant North Face parka or a very large bolero jacket. And along the hemline, the name Tiki is embroidered in a tasteful beige.
Yeah.
Amy says she just couldn't resist. Tiki has enormous brown eyes and thick brown lashes and a long black tongue. She's the zoo's oldest giraffe, 19. That's about 60 in giraffe years. She's a great-great-grandmother. Her progeny live in zoos up and down the West Coast.
She comes from a long line of Bay Area-born giraffes. You'd think she'd be used to the foggy weather, but...
But as Tiki gets older, she's become hypersensitive to the cold, thanks to something called ringbone disease, a kind of giraffe arthritis. Her feet hurt. Her ankles are swollen. She shuffles when she walks.
So it's a really short kind of... She's really easy to tell.
And when Tiki shivers, it's painful. The Oakland Zoo has tried treating the condition with Western medicine, among other things.
Tiki gets a chiropractor, she has an acupuncturist, she has a homeopath, she has a masseuse.
And that's where the giraffe coat comes in. The zoo tries not to call it a coat, too anthropomorphic, but everyone calls it a coat anyway.
We don't want people to think that we're dressing her up in clothes because we think it's cute or because we think it's funny. That would be very disrespectful to her.
Tiki would not comment for this story. Giraffes don't talk. But Amy says Tiki expresses a lot with her body language, and Tiki's feelings about the coat become clear when we approach with it.
Hey!
Tiki stomps her hoof in the dust.
What's that all about?
Amy says the first time she tried to put the coat on Tiki...
She backed away a little bit, and she kind of gave us what we call the eye, which means they kind of turn their head sideways and look at you like, if you think I'm going to stand there and wear that thing, no.
The sound of the Velcro was scary, and the way the coat rubbed her hair in the wrong direction was just plain annoying. So Amy has been training Tiki to wear the coat over the last several weeks. Tiki's making progress. But it still takes three people to dress her when I watch a training session.
Your job is going to be to hold like this so okay. That these don't slap her, but also so that if she spooks and runs away, the coat will come off. Okay. We don't want her to feel like it's attacking her. Good girl, T. Good, steady girl.
After about 5 minutes of maneuvering, Tiki is in her hunter green coat, looking about as absurd as a giraffe in a hunter green coat. The straps around her belly aren't fastened. That'll take a few more training sessions.
This is about as far as we've gotten, getting her used to wearing it.
Amy says she realizes that a giraffe in a coat may be fodder for critics of zoos. Should an animal from the desert really be in a position to need a coat in the first place?
It's kind of funny, you know, although I'm a zookeeper, I definitely understand the argument against zoos. And I think that all I can say about that is that, in my opinion, at least in the near future, zoos aren't going to go away.
And in the meantime, Tiki's cold.
Tiki, we're going to take it off, okay, big girl? Here we go.
At the Oakland Zoo, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
Good girl. Good job.
That green coat goes perfectly with Tiki's big brown eyes. See it for yourself at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. 40 years ago this weekend, a musical called The Education of Hyman Kaplan opened on Broadway. What happens on opening night can make a show or break it. Hyman Kaplan is mostly forgotten now. Ryan Scammell tells us why it's still worth remembering.
On the wall above the light switch in the living room where I grew up, there was a poster of a Broadway show, a musical that opened at the Alvin Theater back in 1968. But it wasn't just any show. Benjamin Zavin, the man who wrote the play, was my stepfather's father. Ben died before I was born, but my stepfather Joshua Zavin remembers the play well.
So I feel like I grew up on the show. They were working on it from the time I was 7 or 8 years old. It was part of my life for the entire time I was in grade school and high school.
The Education of Hyman Kaplan was a comedy about an English language class for immigrants applying for citizenship. The main character, Hyman Kaplan, was an immigrant from Ukraine. And throughout the play, he continually misinterprets both American history and the English language in these kind of funny and endearing ways. But his unabashed love for America was the real message of the play.
A very American story of immigrants making it, and the melting pot story.
And that belief in America and the American dream rang through the music itself.
Hyman Kaplan, under threat of deportation, sings the very hopeful song that anything is possible.
For Ben, my grandfather, his theme was something very personal to him. He was the son of Russian immigrants himself, and this play was his opportunity at the American dream. On April 4th, 1968, his show, The Education of Hyman Kaplan, opened on Broadway.
We felt there was going to be something great.
This is Oscar Brand, who, with Paul Nassau, wrote the music and lyrics to the show.
I don't know if you know what... I think you know what happened to the show.
History changed that night at the Alvin Theater for everyone who was there. But it wasn't the play that the audience would remember. On opening night, my grandfather and Oscar Brand were pacing back and forth in the rear of the theater. The house was packed. The mayor of New York, John Lindsay, was sitting in the middle of the orchestra. The house lights dimmed and the curtain came up and the show began. And then Oscar says, right in the middle of the first act,
a policeman entered, and he hurried across the room, and he crawled down the aisle, and he crawls over two people to Mayor Lindsay, and the two of them crawl back out again. In a little while, back comes Lindsay, crawls down the aisle, and his wife and daughter go with him. They all crawl up the aisle. So there's whispering in the audience, you know. Very hard for the actors to hold their attention. You know, the kind of whispering you get when there's something wrong and nobody knows what it is.
We heard yelling and screaming and backstage.
Tom Bosley, who most of us remember as Richie Cunningham's father on Happy Days, was on stage playing Hyman Kaplan. What Tom was hearing was coming from Donna McKechnie's television.
I had a little television in my dressing room.
She played an Irish immigrant in the play.
And I had my one number after the first act. But before I went down, there was a broadcast that made the announcement.
In the meantime, Oscar saw a man run down to the telephones to find out what had happened. It was Oscar's old friend, Ed Newman.
So he's coming up, and I said, Ed, what's happening? What has happened? Tell me. He says, he's dead. And I, really not wanting to know the answer, said, who's dead? And he said, Martin Luther King. He was just killed, just assassinated today.
The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was shot to death by an assassin late today as he stood on a balcony in Memphis, Tennessee.
No one can believe what has happened.
And you go, oh my God, my heart started beating.
Donna McKechnie was still backstage waiting for her entrance.
I mean, that's the feeling I remember. Oh, my God. What? How could this happen? Oh, dear, this is a tragedy. This is awful. And, you know, wait, come on. I hear my cue. We got to get down. Let's do it. Ain't it a pretty night?
But by this point, no one in the audience was paying attention to the song. They were wondering why the mayor of New York had just been pulled out of the theater. And at intermission, they found out from a man walking past the theater.
He was walking along. He saw the audience waiting outside the theater. And he said very loudly, "What are you people laughing about? Don't you know that Martin Luther King has just been killed and the whole country is coming down here and rioting?"
By the time Act Two began, a quarter of the audience had left. But something else had changed too, something that became clear in a scene at the end of the play. The immigrants are all heading to the judge's quarters to be sworn in as citizens, and one of the characters is waving an American flag.
And everybody was singing, "We're going to be all American, all American, all American today. We're going to be all American." But they were so happy, and he was had the flag, and they were going to become citizens, and the first thought that hit you was, why?
And that was the problem. Hyman Kaplan is an American dream show. It's a show that's whole focus is the dream of freedom and equality. And yet with the news of Martin Luther King's assassination, those themes ran contrary to everything that everyone was feeling at that moment.
We felt like a black sheep in the middle of the world. That's what we were. We had let this happen. There was a distaste that must have communicated somewhat to a show which was talking about what a great country this was, this is, and could be.
That hopelessness, that feeling, you know, all of the beautiful ideals were shot down.
It was clear within the first week that if audience numbers didn't begin to pick up, the show was going to have to close. And it did, before the month was out. In those months leading up to opening night, the education on Hyman Kaplan was the most important thing in the world for my grandfather and everyone else who was involved in the show, including my stepfather, Josh.
And I confess, I'm a little bit embarrassed. At age 17, I wasn't fully aware of the significance of Martin Luther King. In some ways, I was in my own smaller world and just realizing this was affecting my father's show. I realize in retrospect, you know, what an event it was and why it caused such disruption. And in the days after, when Broadway was virtually brought to a standstill with fear of rioting, I started to absorb the impact of what had happened.
Usually we can live in our own little worlds. But on April 4th, 1968, that all changed. When a bullet crossed the street and entered the man who was standing on the balcony of room 308 at the Lorraine Motel.
Anything is possible.
In New York, I'm Ryan Scammell for Week in America.
You're listening to Weekend America from American Public Media. We're glad to have you with us. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul. My mother in Virginia has been calling me for weeks to talk about the gardening that she's been doing. It's a dagger in my heart. Here in St. Paul, I'm still waiting for just the tiniest patch of green. And Bill, you don't help matters either there in Los Angeles.
No,
always bragging
that
about the beach weather.
Yes.
Well, the vernal equinox is the first day of spring, March 20th. For some of you, that's when the spring really did show up. And for the rest of us, we've got to close our eyes and imagine what spring's like. Like these school children in Michigan. They're still waiting for the first signs of the season.
How do you know it's spring?
So how do you know it's spring?
I know it's spring because when the ice melts.
I know about spring because it rains and you can wear shorts.
I like spring because you can go outside with bare feet.
I know why it's spring because I like to catch butterflies and the sun shining and the birds sing.
Because you don't have to wear snow pants and you can wear short sleeves.
What else do you like about spring?
The flowers bloom.
You can go camping more.
You can rollerblade outside.
When you can plant flowers and the birds start to sing.
This is Jane Streelman, kindergarten teacher at Granville Christian School, and her students. Everybody say hi.
Hi!
We have had a very long winter. In fact, we've had a record-breaking winter, more than 100 inches of snow. And we've had blizzards and snow days, which means no school. And the big kids and the teachers like, oh, we get to sleep in. But usually the kindergartners are like, oh, we can't come to school. Right, guys? And because it's been a long, deep winter, we end up having to take minutes and minutes and minutes to get ready to go outside for recess. And now we can just zip right out there and have a lot of fun outside. So we're glad to see spring come.
I like spring because the grass grows green.
Kindergarten teacher Jane Strillman and her class at Granville Christian School in Granville, Michigan. There are absolutely great drawings of the kids' impressions of spring. They're flying kites, roller skating, dancing through the flowers. Visit the kids' art on our virtual refrigerator door. Go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
I know it's spring, but it is still ski season in the Cascades. The Northwest is getting rain and snow this weekend. Here's more about weekend weather with John Moe.
You may be a murderous bad guy, but if you can just hold out for a century or so, you can be a hero. For proof, observe Hyco, Texas, site of the annual Billy the Kid Day, held under sun and 76 degrees. Look for arts and crafts and Texas trail hands. The event is less popular among thwarted jail keepers and people who don't like being murdered. Neihardt, Montana has a mountain and a bunch of mannequins. I think we can all pretty much guess what's going to happen next. Dummies are hurled, observed in mid-flight, and then shatter upon impact. I'm guessing there are adult beverages involved here at some point. Rain, snow, 36 degrees, 100% chance of whimsically adorned mannequins falling from the sky. Want to enjoy all the fun of the early 19th century, but without all those bothersome smallpox epidemics? Get to Durant, Oklahoma for the Mountain Man Fur Trade Rendezvous with educational exhibits and competitions. Enjoy sun and 71 degrees, and bring your camera, or as they would have called it back then, your spooky face-stealing box. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
For all you college basketball fans, the science behind March Madness. Well, actually, there is no science behind March Madness. Coming up on Weekend America. From American Public Media, I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. This weekend, the NCAA basketball tournament is down to Kansas, Memphis, North Carolina, and UCLA. It's the first time the four number one teams from each region have actually made it to the Final Four.
Today's winners go to Monday's championship game in San Antonio, and fans will be watching it all to find out how they did in the brackets. That's the betting pool of the tournament.
Week in America's Charlie Schroeder will be singing a swan song if he hasn't picked the winner on Monday, so he turned to a statistician for help.
Did you know that there's a
1 in 345 million chance of being perfect all the way through the NCAA tournament?
That's Adam Sugano. He's getting his PhD in statistics at UCLA. I asked him to calculate the odds of predicting the winners of all 63 games in this year's NCAA men's basketball tournament, which he did.
If you have two events, A and B, that are independent, then the probability of A and B is just equal to the probability of A times the probability of B.
I'm not going to play you everything he said because I don't know what he's talking about. Long story short, the chances of filling out a perfect bracket are very slim.
My name is Horace Washington, but most of, you know, my friends call me H.
That's my colleague Horace, H. He's a basketball junkie. This year, the two of us conducted a little experiment. He used his vast knowledge of the game to help him fill out his bracket. You know, stuff like this.
With college, I think there's a lot more purity to the game. The players don't run the team. The tempo is a little bit more, you know, it's faster pace.
While I, a basketball know-nothing, filled out my bracket with the help of my friends, a group who knows even less about the sport than I do. Par exemple?
I think regardless of how many Hail Mary passes they actually do throw, it's called throwing, right?
Yeah. It's shooting, actually, but that's okay.
Shooting. All right.
H and I established some simple rules for our bet. Whoever picks the most winners wins. But the stakes, well, they prove to be a bit more complicated.
If I win, you have to take me out to lunch.
Okay, so if I win, then you have to sing one of our songs on the radio.
I have to sing one of your songs on the radio.
Yeah. You could be Michael Bolton.
Oh, I forgot to mention, H Moonlight says the R&B producer, H-Dub.
Thanks for this one, H-Dub. I didn't want to go here, but I had to.
Now, for someone who's tone deaf, singing on the radio is about as nightmarish as it gets. So I really hoped my friends could help me.
Mississippi State versus Oregon.
What are we even talking about, old boy?
The Stanford-Cornell game. Who do you think's going to win?
Oh, well, that I have no idea about.
While my friends were, advising me, H was crunching numbers on basketball websites and subsisting on a diet of sports talk shows. Consider his pregame analysis of the Davidson-Gonzaga matchup.
I think Davidson will beat Gonzaga because point guard play is better. They have a bona fide star. Gonzaga, they really don't have a bona fide star like, you know, a couple of years ago when they had Adam Morrison, who was a really prolific scorer. You know, he could shoot, he could drive. They really don't have that.
I want to love you. B-Y-T. Pretty young thing.
It was becoming more and more apparent to me that I would lose and have to sing on Weekend America. So, in the days leading up to the tournament, I attempted to unearth my inner R&B singer.
I need some lovin', me only, then a lovin' can, wow, take it back.
Needless to say, I couldn't find him.
CBS begins its 27th row to the Final Four today in our nation's capital and lead away.
The tournament's first weekend was its most exciting and epitomized what Adam Sugano, the UCLA statistician, had told me earlier.
You know, the NCAA tournament is kind of predictably unpredictable.
In fact, that Friday, four teams were upset in Tampa alone, including Drake, when Western Kentucky beat them at the buzzer.
Leaves it for Rogers for three for the win! Western Kentucky doesn't break!
H didn't predict this, but one of my friends did.
Drake versus Western Kentucky. Who do you like?
Western Kentucky.
Why?
Because I have no idea where Drake is.
And when everyone was predicting Connecticut would crush San Diego, my friend knew better.
Connecticut versus San Diego.
I think San Diego still has a higher median house price right now. So I'm going to, yeah, I'll say San Diego then.
The next time I saw Horace, I showed him my bracket.
Look at my friend bracket though, dude. 37.
Are you serious?
Look at this. They picked Western Kentucky and San Diego.
You know, I shouldn't be doing this, H-Dub. My bracket beat your bracket. That wasn't the bet, but I have a soft spot in my heart.
As of this morning, H has 42 correct picks. I have 46. And so with only three games left, well, I win. Lunch is on him. But I feel kind of bad beating him, so out of sympathy and an apparent lack of shame, I'm still going to sing his song.
Please don't sweat me, boy, you crazy.
We won't know the winner of the tournament until Monday night. H thinks it'll be UCLA. He likes their guards. I'm rooting for, well, I'll let my friend John tell you.
Who do you think's going to be the champion at the end of the tournament?
I think UNC.
The North Carolina Tar Heels.
UNC.
That's where I was born.
That's right, because he was born there. Hey, why not? At this rate, the odds are pretty good. I'm Charlie Schroeder for Weekend America.
Hang out pregame with Charlie and H. Go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Another hour of Weekend America has gone by. Thanks for being with us. Our show is produced with Ben Adair, who's boxing up this weekend, moving two neighborhoods over. Also, Julia Barton, Angela Kim, Jim Gates says he's going to watch Kansas beat the tar out of the Tar Heels this weekend. Millie Jefferson, also E. Okobi, is gorging on Thai food this weekend for her birthday. Philip Stern says he's trying to take over the world this weekend, which is alarming. Sam Keenan, Michael Raphael, and Tim Bamba.
Also Rob Byers, Susie Lechtenberg, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Newnham, who's doing what they've been doing in California for centuries, grilling bison under the stars. There's Michael May, David Banks, who's doing his taxes and then crying himself to sleep this weekend. Phyllis Owens, John Moe, who's really excited about a four-day visit from his mother-in-law. No, really, he is excited. And Mart Sanchez. A special thanks to Jess Mador and Laura Ewan.
Galactic created our theme music. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney, who's 18-month-old, is at work helping him executive produce. Jim Russell created the program, and you can get a free podcast of it and take us with you when you come spend some time at our website, weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. It's your weekend. Enjoy it.
Weekend America is supported by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness online at loveandforgive.org. And made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul. And made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Hi, I'm Bill Radke, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for exploring.
I've really enjoyed Georgia. It's been extremely rural, very friendly.
For the 10 dogs that are running toward us right now.
That really is. Let's cross the street.
It was really scary because I thought they were going to capsize our boat. When you got fish attacking you, that's wrong.
Becoming one with nature, plus a whole lot more. It's Weekend America every Saturday. Join us.